Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we've got some notes from the field. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at a potential other use for aspirin besides your headache. Egg History Minute, we'll talk about Milwaukee Bucks legend Don Nelly Nelson. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, so we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. It's been an interesting week this last week. We're getting cold enough at night, we get fog. Sometimes localized fog, because the other morning I left, there's no fog, and then ran into some very thick fog.
And I went the opposite. One morning I was in the sunshine, and I got here, and it was thick.
The Tilth World headquarters tends to have fog whenever anybody else has fog. I don't know why it's... I think it follows through the big cities of Black Creek and Shockton, kind of in that low bowl of Outagamie County. And just, so yes, Matt was right. It was cool to drive where we had clear sailing. And then I too drove into that fog and was a little bit bummed and talked to a few, like with flying drones and some of the things we do with that. It's always a bummer when you're getting grounded and the plan is to fly the drone. And then when you can't, It's hard.
I flew the drone at a field day about a month or so ago. It was right when we had that spurt of wildfire smoke where it was hanging around for like 2-3 days. And I was flying and it wasn't bad enough you couldn't see like the drone or anything, but the smoke was just there. And it was kind of eerie like looking back at the pictures and even flying the drone, like looking around because it just looked like a constant fog everywhere. And then, I drove through Oneida, and, like, that was real thick, low-visibility fog. And then I went into it on one side, drove through to the other side, and then the sun came out again. It was just kind of this weird, like, just hole of fog. Hmm. So.
It's been sneaky hot, too.
Yes. I keep saying every day this week to farmers, I say, "Oh, it's going to cool off, though. It's going to cool off," and then
it just doesn't.
And then, about midweek, one of the farmers like, "It's." They said today it was going to be high like of the low 80s or high 70s, and it was like high 80s yet. So yes, I agree, Bill. It's been like sneaky hot, and just the amount of humid that it does make it uncomfortable. Where we're outside in it, and you're like, "Oof, this is enough that, I don't know if it's the fog part of it too or what it exactly is, but
I'm ready for fall.
I did see a thing that like the Corn Belt is in this big humid ball and like central Iowa is as humid as the Amazon. Like
They say the dreaded,
instead of a heat dome, we're in a humid dome?
CS word. Did they blame it on our buddy?
Sweat?
Yes.
No.
Did they blame it on?
No.
That's been out of when it's blamed on corn sweat and when it's not.
No, they were just talking. I've seen, and I think I shared you guys the pictures of the big storm that rolled through
the Derecho.
Yeah, Indiana. And
or Derecho.
Derecho.
What you say, Derecho, I say Derecho.
Derecho.
I don't know.
I'd like some derachos with nacho cheese.
I'll take some derachos and cheese, please. Yes.
Maybe they should start serving those in the affected areas.
I feel like that would be a fair food.
It does sound like a fair
food. It does sound, yes.
I did hear the coolest fair food ever, though.
Ooh, I bet you I know.
At the state fair.
And I Is it the deep fried ranch?
No.
Okay.
Deep fried ranch?
Yes. Apparently they.
You can deep fry ranch.
Some sort of batter ball.
Yes, surrounding the ranch. It's like a ranch wad, I'm guessing, but we will try to confirm anybody that's.
Or if they have to freeze it, then batter it and fry it, and then it goes back to.
And then it kind of. But I would think ranch could get really nasty if you deep fried that incorrectly.
Hot ranch doesn't sound like a good
thing. Agreed. That's,
no.
So it's ranch is always good, but all right. So Bill, what is
guess it's like a jalapeno popper, but in like that.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm speculating at this point.
So it was called the Wisconsin forgot what it was called. It was basically a pretzel bun in the shape of an Wisconsin ice cream cone. That's what it was called, I think. Pretzel bun, shape of an ice cream cone. So think about an ice cream cone, but it's a pretzel bun. They put brat in it.
Cream city cone.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
All right.
Cheese, brat, onions, mustard.
There's no ice cream, though.
No.
Okay.
But the...
Sorry, my brain... you said ice cream, and then I assume there was some sort of ice cream. But
Cream City Cone, that's what it's called.
It says a pretzel cone with a bratwurst, onions, cheddar, and a cheese curd on top.
Cheese curd, that's right. They put a cheese curd.
Nice. Yeah. That's a cool...
And you just, like...
That's your cherry.
Yeah. Instead of, like, eating a bun, you eat it in a cone.
That was my kids, when we were in Florida, they wanted to try it. They were... Mac and cheese cones. It was like garlic bread with mac and cheese in the cone. So must be a new thing to try to make these different kinds of cones.
Everything's in cones.
Bread in a cone. I wonder if you can buy a bread-shaped cone of different sorts.
Somebody is. I don't know if they're making them in-house. Or. Yeah.
They're doing some, it must be, was it 150 years of the fair, 175, something like that?
And yeah, 175th.
And they're doing the cherry cream puff.
Yep, the Ferrachino cherry cream puff.
That would be kind of because of the 175 years.
Those cream puffs are so good anyway that, you throw something like cherries on or something would be. So are they Door County cherries?
They're more tart, though, right?
Yeah, you can get sweet ones up
there. That's a maraschino cherry, which is...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's not...
Yeah, it says the top new foods and treats for the state fair are Berea Flaming Bombs, the Ferrachino Cream Puff, Cream City Cone, the Wisco Short Rib Corn Dog, it's a Bray short rib and Gouda skewer in a beer cornbread batter,
nice,
and a bugged out frozen cheesecake on a stick, which is chocolate cheesecake topped with real candy crickets and worms. So,
this fair goes through
3 more days.
Yep, Sunday? You got till Sunday.
So
go grab your.
Yep.
It seems like a long fair, and then all of a sudden it's over.
It's agreed. It's like and it seems like one of those things. Like, we'll get there, and then we never seem to get there.
It is. It's been a few years since I've been down to state fair, but it's the challenge of you gotta get to Milwaukee. Then you got to get into State Fair Park to park somewhere or on the periphery. Like, Todd, you remember that time we went down? This was a long time
ago. Long time, but
we parked in, like, it was like some guy's salvage yard right across from the State Fair Park.
Hopefully he didn't mistake in your vehicle for...
Luckily, he might have cut your brakes. We don't really know. I believe that was the time where
you had brake problems.
Your brakes.
Yeah, I did, but that was because we were avoiding an accident on the highway. But
no, Matt luckily saved our lives, and almost and then proceeded to drive another 10 miles with very little to no brakes. But
we survived.
We survived, and you're right. The parking part, you're right, was definitely sketchy, and one of those where...
Like, it was cheaper parking. We went in. They seemed a little rough, but they were fine. We came back, and they had, like, this big gate, and it was closed, and it was like, oh no, did they just steal our car?
We just pay to get our car stolen?
Were there other fairgoers parking
there? Oh yeah, there were lots of other people parking there. And they did, they just opened the gate for us. Actually, our car was probably safer than most places as a result of this, but it was one of those things where it was like, oh no, did we just make a huge mistake here?
That's awesome.
But it was fine, they were good. He was the stereotypical guy, too. I remember, like, there was a crew of people, like, parking, but the guy in charge had, like, a big old stogie, a short guy, just sitting there, come on in and park. It was an experience.
He's had a hard life.
Yep.
Yes.
A little rough looking, but.
That's awesome.
All good. All right, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yeah.
So, Todd, what do you got for some notes this week?
So, notes from the field started out. I would say the field notes this year are fairly average to below average as far as there's just not a ton going on, which is good news for farmers.
I had my employee yesterday tell a farm, it's been boring scouting this year. Like, really boring.
Which is the best, like, no news is good news.
Right.
Keep on telling farmers, like, if you don't hear from me, that's a good thing in general. So, just been a, boring year. Definitely less than normal. And so, talking today about some of the insects we have been finding, but I do want to start with the disclaimer of we're going to get into some of the physiology of one of the insects, mainly because there's just not a lot going on out in the field. The disease levels, I started kind of thinking about that. And is there some northern corn leaf blight out there? Yes. Is there some southern rust in parts of the state? A little
bit of tar spot, too.
In tar spot, yes. It's there. But is it this mass sort of create panic? No. And I think too much in sort of today's media and today's ag media, we need a story or we need something to talk about. And it's odd when I look up the stories, there's just nothing about anything because there's just that little going on. So that's a good thing to sort of start with and kind of give that peace of mind to farmers that when we have a boring summer scouting, That's a really, really good thing. So the first one that just we get questions from farmers and about their soybean fields, but also about like people's gardens, or they'll see it on some sort of this pest is just kind of it goes all over, but it's the Japanese beetle. So
they're so shiny.
Yes, I think part of it is their look. They always look, they kind of bunch up, they tend to, when they're going to do damage, their damage just looks very severe. And on soybeans especially, they tend to congregate around the headlands, and they get quite a bit less when you get inside. So this is one too where you want to kind of make sure you get past the field edges and inside, and then also the upper canopy they concentrate on and not so much the lower canopy. So they eat the tissue between the veins, and then it looks skeletonized, which also can look a lot worse than what it is sometimes.
Not can, Todd. It does. Like,
it does, yes.
It's like, this is like farmer freak out.
Right.
Like, they're so big, so it's like, oh my God, they're huge. They're just going to eat everything.
And there's usually three of them.
Yes.
Every once in a while you see one, but then there's clumps of like two to three, sometimes four.
And they're typically mating, which also makes me laugh because some of my scouts, were like, they have quite the habits of feeding and mating. So
sometimes at the same time.
Yes. So they're quite the bug. But appearance, he said that shiny bronze, and then aggregate in groups. So you're going to start seeing them, and they feed from the top of the plant down. So the that is one part as far as a threshold goes, is you really are supposed to look at the whole plant. And that even, to me, is by the time they get to the whole plant, you're probably too late. But one of the spots I would tend to look at is inside of the field and then the middle canopy. So we know they're going to feed a lot in the upper, but say they're feeding on the middle canopy and it's starting to get to
then,
the...
Then it's time to freak out.
Then it right, then it may be more time. But if you just see a couple on the top, or usually it's not a couple, many, there's a party going on the top, it's when they get to that middle floor that it's a little different. And threshold is when the foliation's at 30% at vegetative stage, so before bloom, and then after bloom or reproductive stage, when you're in our stage, which is typically when we see them, the threshold drops actually to 20%. So
that's every plant across the whole field, right?
80% of the field, I believe, is the threshold, what the UW book says. Is if it reaches 20% defoliation on 80% of the field.
That's still a lot.
But it also says the full canopy, too, not just the upper...
You have to look at the whole plant.
The whole plant, yeah. Yes.
Not 20% of a leaf.
Right.
It's got to be 20% of the entire plant.
Which usually it's... It could be 20% of two or three leaves on a... Like, when you see the feeding, it's a handful of leaves.
Right.
It's less than 10% of the plant, usually, right?
Right.
So it's not... To get to this threshold, it's going to take a lot of feeding.
The best saying, and I don't know where, if this had to be UW or something like that, but, and I remember writing down about Japanese beetles because it said, if you look at the entire field and it looks like 50% is gone, then it's actually 30% and it's time to spray. Like 30% too looks like, when you get to 30%, most farmers would be like, it's all gone,
yeah.
The leaves. So that's what's odd about that number two, Bill, is the amount just doesn't... That defoliation number is hard to wrap your brain around. Matt, you had some like 3D printed soybean leaves.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I should need to get a set of those.
Those would be neat to have in your pocket to just be like, hey, this is what...
Yeah, I think it's 10, 20, and 30.
Matt is currently going to grab them after pointing towards them. And they're like a mock-up of a soybean leaf, and then they have that amount missing, basically.
Yeah, so it's three leaves, 10, 15, and 30 is what percent defoliation...
And 30 looks like...
Yeah, 30 looks like half. 50.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's what you said, right?
That's,
when it looks like half, it's really 30.
Right. And that just doesn't... I still don't get that. If it's your brain playing a trick on you, or how... Because to hold up the leaf, you still need enough leaf. Because it still looks like a leaf. It's right. Not like it's...
Right. That's the problem with the way they feed, is it's intraveinal.
Yes.
So they're eating out the inside. You've still got structure there.
Yeah.
So it just looks awful all the time. Looks like somebody ate you down to your bones.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Is that the new quote? Ate you down to your bones.
Jeffrey Dahmer style.
Yeah.
But yeah, it this year it's been weird, like... I noticed it probably, I want to say like 3 weeks ago. I was really starting to like wonder, like, oh, seems like they moved in and there was a lot of them. And so I've been watching soybean fields for the last like 3 weeks. And I'm not saying it's not getting worse, because it is getting worse than it was initially, as far like there wasn't a lot of damage initially. But it's not getting as bad as fast as I, like my brain said it should be. Like, oh, there's so many of them out here. Like, this is going to go to heck. Like, I really got to keep an eye on this. And thankfully, I mean, I'm not mad. It hasn't been bad enough to trigger actually doing anything about them.
Right.
So it looks bad, but it's not as bad as it looks.
That's the part, too, with the triggering... Something gets hard because you don't want to wait till it's too late, but you definitely want to wait till it feels like you already waited too long.
Yeah, and there is a harvest interval to insecticide, so you got to watch that too. Of like, I mean, we're almost mid-August here, if you're 20 days harvest restricted, like, depending on your bean maturities and stuff, September, end of September comes around. I mean, that's a month away. So 30-some days.
Shh.
If you're taking...
Don't wish away summer, man.
20 of those days away, like, your window to spray is kind of shrinking here.
Yeah, it does range on that, so it's a good point, man. It's 14 to 60 days pre-harvest intervals on sort of the common insecticides, but some of your warriors do have, like, a 30-day. Some of them have down to 21-day, like a Mustang Max. So, depend, like you say, you're going to have to potentially watch out for that, too.
We usually play the same game with wheat of, like, if armyworm gets bad late, you're like, oh, we should really spray. And then it's like, oh, we got like 2 weeks to harvest, though. And
might as well just harvest.
Yeah.
That's the interval of the insecticide. So.
Yep. And you bring up a good point on them feeling like they come in barrages, but at the same time, we had this sort of steady, not heavy enough pressure. But the adults do fly easily, they're very mobile. And sprayed fields can also be reinfested fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to consider, too. Like, you spray once, one, you're going to kill a lot of the natural enemies, not for this bug. There's not other bug natural enemies, but for soybean aphid, you may kill all your lady beetle larvae, and then...
You're killing beneficials with...
Right, and then you could... end up making a bigger mess for yourself, potentially. So it is...
You mean the trash bag guys who tell you to spray at the first sign of an aphid?
Right.
Maybe isn't great advice for Wisconsin?
Nope. Well, on our farm, Matt, we see that the soybean aphid threshold is
maybe
in
the Dakotas that's the way it works. Yes. But here, yeah, you might just be creating a bigger problem because now you killed everything that's going to eat the aphids. And the aphids, and now a second flush of aphids shows up.
So this would be one as well to consider that beneficial side. Now, as far as natural predators, there's no other bugs like a lady bee. These are kind of one of the bigger insects we deal with, so they are kind of the top of that hierarchy.
You need some birds.
Right, birds, and a lot of those eat more of like, so these are white grubs is what they start out as. And a lot of those birds will really eat the grubs, take care of them that way. They will eat the beetles, but eat the adults. But it's odd for predators, birds, starlings, skunks, moles, shrews. I mean, they don't have a lot of normal.
You mean starlings are actually good for something?
Yeah, dang. There you go. They don't seem to be in... Yeah, bring them from your feed pile.
Yeah.
Where they're
bring them from your barn.
From the barn and just out to the field.
Throw them in your soybeans.
But no, there's not as much for natural predators on the Japanese beetle. So it's quite frustrating that way. And one of how they got here is they came shipped accidentally as soil-dwelling grubs inside plant root balls on cargo ships from Japan, and that was kind of before any quarantine laws existed. So this is the early 1900s that they got here, and then they've really been able to move quite easily and kind of populate all over. So kind of a frustrating bug.
Japanese beetles in your garden, Asian lady beetles in your house.
Yeah. And there's kind of a myth that you shouldn't squish the Japanese beetles. Have you heard this? That, like, you don't want to squish a bunch of them?
Have not.
Don't they say that about, like, yellow jackets, too? Like, if you...
Yeah, there's...
If you squish one, it brings other ones
like
there.
It to, like, releases, like, an
avenge them.
Or I'm still going to squish them.
Yeah.
Yellow jackets, I'm still squishing, Matt.
I do, too. But, yeah, it's just like... through pheromones, are saying, avenge me!
Yeah. But no, this one does not. When you squish them, it doesn't really release some sort of attractant or pheromone that's going to call more to it. So that's not a real thing. But they do seem, they the damaged plants actually seems to draw more beetles than the beetle itself. So they're attracted.
They're all coming to the buffet.
Right. They're attracted. That's why you see them in these pockets, is the scent is the scent of the damaged plant.
Nobody else is eating the salad. They want to eat the salad. Yes. They're coming up to the salad bar.
So yeah, that's the Japanese beetle. And I like the one other thing to think about is traps. So one of the things said, well, I'll put a bunch of those and it's the bags you see hanging.
Yep.
And the advice from most entomologists, especially on a commercial egg side, is not to put up those traps, is because that'll attract them. Yes, you'll trap a bunch, but you'll attract them to your field then. Now, as a garden owner or homeowner, or I'll see them like in our local parks, they'll put them by certain trees that are affected. That's a little different, that if you know they're going to come there anyway and they're showing up to the party, then it's okay to trap them and to try to pull them off.
When it's such a localized small, you don't have acres and acres of garden.
Yeah, right. Correct.
It's
a good way to put it too.
Well, and I put one out last year because they were so bad in the garden.
Yes.
I wanted to pull them away. And the traps do say, I think it's 30 feet, at least 30 feet away from the target plants, and then I think it's downwind, or is it upwind? Can't remember, but either way, like, so that they find the bag first before they get to
what you're trying,
whatever you're trying to protect.
Yeah, so it's, and like you say, Bill, you're right. Like, if you're trying to pull them away from a small area, it works.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to avoid a field, it's just not going to work, and you might attract
or you might pull away like those beetles in a garden-sized area in your field.
Right. Woo-hoo. You need a lot of traps.
We did it. We got a 20 by 30 area.
Yeah.
Well, free and clear Japanese beetles.
It always amazes me. Like, we'll set out traps around our sweet corn patch just because they, and that'd be maybe the last thing to talk about is them on corn, but right at pollination time, they'll eat silks on your corn, so that can be frustrating. That can be a source that you have to spray in a cornfield, but once you're past that, once they're pollinated, they can eat those brown silks away and they can do their deal in the corn. But
I don't know about you guys. I didn't really see much in corn at all this year.
Not this year.
No, not this year.
It seemed like they came in after pollination, and maybe that's why we're seeing so many in the beans.
Good point.
They're not as interested in post-pollinated. In that tassel is much sweeter, I don't know, or better tasting to them pre-pollination, but... Yeah, I've noticed it way more in soy, which in general we see them more in soybeans.
Correct.
But I have seen them clipping silks.
Yeah, the clipping silks thing is something to watch. But then, like I said, once that comes, you're good. And if you got a, like sweet corn, usually if you got a big area, it's not going to be a problem. But say a littler patch, like a garden style, then these traps are helpful. But there's times where they'll fill that whole bag and you gotta go, you know, dump them out and kind of start back over, fill in the bag and
drown them
and stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. I've seen my favorite, and it'd be cool to try it if you had chickens, but put like the top of the trap basically, above your chicken coop, and then the guy had a pipe down and then the chickens would basically eat them. As they kind of came down the pipe. So that was a good technique to take care of them. But yeah, that's the Japanese beetle. So
yeah, and like you said before, otherwise we've had some localized soybean aphids. Like I had a field that actually was really as close as I've seen in a long time to possibly needing intervention. It doesn't. The field doesn't need it, as the beneficials were showing up and eating them, and they were starting to molt and die and everything else. So that's one thing, I guess, with some of these things. Like early on, there were pockets where armyworm was real bad. Like every year, you might get certain insects in certain spots that are bad. It's not always widespread. Like for us in this area, we didn't really get that armyworm. We had a little bit of cutworm maybe in some fields real early. Aphids have been relatively non-existent. Bill, you've been fighting spider mites, right? Which is
yeah, very areas. Very localized areas. Seems like northern Calumet County kind of has been missing some rains, so that's where I was finding pressure. And it was there was some within the field itself, but it was mainly the typical like field edge, very robust ditch, like road ditch. So I think a lot of grass where they were harboring, and then they moved into the soybean field. We're going to treat just because they're plenish beans and they're very nice beans, and that particular couple fields normally doesn't yield very well. So we're actually have a good yield this year, which...
So you don't need the complication of right. the spider mite and taking away that yield.
Those two fields, when we do have a drier year, do well. So we're just kind of not surprised that they're there, but at the same point, we're just going to just get rid of them. So, but otherwise, yeah, spider mites have been... I kind of expected with how dry it's been them to be a little bit more of a problem. But the beans have... I mean, the beans are so nice that I think they're just...
Sure, that they kind of
keep it ahead of it, too.
Yeah, I know far north, like you get Lena and North, they've been really dry, too. So I'm sure they're probably experiencing some issues up there. I know there's pretty rough corn.
I'll tell you in a couple hours, Matt. That's
where you're headed
next.
I think they did get rain yesterday, though, because I was up not quite that far north, like Gillett-Suring area, and it was fairly wet. So the rain we didn't get overnight here, I think they got up there, which is good. They needed it more than we did. So,
One thing odd about this year, insect infestations are always sporadic, and I would call them this year, they're almost erratic. They're not very predictable, besides maybe spider mite, like you said, Bill, where it's dry.
Yep.
You watch in your fields that way, and that makes sense for that kind of that stippling, they call it, instead of just drying up, it sort of gets that bronze to it, and just can you tell from the road on those this year where it's like, ooh, that's spider mite, or is it get out the white piece of paper?
The bad ones, it was tell from the road.
Yeah.
And the farmer's like, I know I had some herbicide issues, but this looks different.
Sure.
And I'm like, well, we saw a few of them last week, and I was like, yeah, my guess is what it is, but we'll be there later today, and I'll let you know. And yeah, you can actually, Todd, with these camera phones now.
Yeah. You can zoom in that well. You can. Well,
like,
sure.
You get that leaf within a half an inch from your phone, and it focuses. You can actually see the mite crawling.
Sure.
We've come so far.
Yeah.
You don't need your...
We're in the year 2000. You look at spider mites on a phone.
You laugh, Matt, but it's real.
It's real.
It's real.
And I always felt like weird with that hand lens holding it up to your eye and trying to look. And it's
you still have to be like, I found that like direct sunlight. Like I was trying to show a guy in his shop yesterday. It's hard to see. Like, let's go outside, get in the sunlight, then you can see.
Sure,
but. I was amazed because my right-hand lady's like, you can just use your phone. I'm like, oh, shoot. You can just use your phone. It works really good. Give it a minute to focus. And
the other day, and that makes it, I took a very zoomed-in picture of my jeans. I like was going to take a picture, and I set it down on my pants, on the leg, you know, and then all of a sudden, I'm like, what is this? You know, like one of those weird... pictures the
surface of Mars. No wait, yes. My jeans.
Yes, and they're like, oh, that's blue jeans, very zoomed in, and that would make sense then that you could see. I did not see any spider mites.
That's on good. My jeans. There are no spider mites crawling on your jeans. All right. Well, we'll hopefully be out of the woods when it comes to insects soon, but still a good idea to be keeping an eye on your fields to make sure that. You don't need to take action against some of these late season pests. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So aspirin is showing promise in addressing some no-till plant stresses. A farmer in Ohio field trials, they applied salicylic acid or aspirin with their sprayer to show or see what it would do when drought and heat stress were affecting soybeans. So plant stresses can be a headache for farmers and a yield killer in crops. Extended dry periods reduce water availability, while high temperatures can intensify the plant stress, often leading to lower yields and poorer grain quality. When drought and heat waves occur together, crops become especially vulnerable to wilting, poor pollination, stunted growth, and even premature death, according to Rafiq Islam, the research scientist at Ohio State University College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. The greatest damage occurs during growth stages such as flowering, pollination, and grain filling. With even a few days of severe stress, can significantly reduce yields. Although both corn and soybeans are affected, soybeans are particularly sensitive to drought and heat stress, he said. Consequently, alleviating plant stress is being targeted by a growing number of biological offerings in the marketplace. One promising solution is involving aspirin or salicylic acid, a naturally occurring plant compound closely related to the active ingredients in aspirin, as a simple, inexpensive, and easy-to-adopt management practice. Foliar application of salicylic acid offers a practical strategy for improving soybean resilience to drought and heat stress. This approach has the potential to reduce yield and grain quality losses as drought, heat waves, and other extreme weather events become increasingly frequent under weather-related challenges. In soybeans, salicylic acid reduces electrolyte leakage, particularly the loss of potassium from the leaves, which is an indicator of damage to plant cell membranes. So by protecting cell membrane integrity during environmental stress, salicylic acid helps soybean plants maintain healthier physiological functions under drought and high temperature conditions. So this has been tried out on the Brandt farm near Carroll, Ohio. Chris Brandt is the farmer, looking to mitigate stress and protect his yield. He worked with Islam and the Ohio Soybean Council to investigate the ability of foliar-applied salicylic acid to improve soybean production under stressful conditions last year in 2025. So it's unfortunately not something you're going to time with other applications. It's more of a timing right before you get into the stress, say high temperatures with a lot of sun. It was applied through a scientific measurement called molarity rather than an application rate per acre. Was an amount of dissolved product per unit of liquid. We were using 0.04 and 0.02 molarity for test rates. And he said, I'm not sure what the suggested rates per acre would be, but once you know how much you need per given amount of liquid, you just pour it into your inductor and you're ready to go. So the trial was conducted in a 45-acre long term no-tilled cover cropped field with control strips of no sodium salicylate application, 0.02 molarity and 0.04. Brandt says there was a noticeable yield improvement where the product was applied, although not at the point of making a profit from it. So still early stages here. So don't go out and grind up a bunch of aspirin and throw it in the tank.
How many are you? So it's not for the farmer to take a few.
Yeah, nuts. Don't drink the salicylic acid if you have a headache. Yeah. It's just really closely related to aspirin. They're not grinding right. up actual aspirin. But keep an eye on it. Maybe if it shows improvement and they find out a actual application rate that makes sense, it could be something we see in the future. So now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. All right, this week we're talking about Milwaukee Bucks coach Don Nelly Nelson, who passed away at the age of 86 earlier this week. Beyond his Hall of Fame basketball career, he famously drove a donated tractor across Wisconsin in the summers of 1986 and 1987 after receiving letter from a Burnham Wood, Wisconsin farmer, Clarence Wilcombe. The letter asked for advice on the fear of losing his cattle and having his farm foreclosed. Buckcoach said he grew up on a farm and knew of the troubles that Wilcombe was facing. So he drove a donated $50,000 tractor from Case IH while towing a huge piggy bank he named Barkley after Buck's nemesis, Charles Barkley of the Philadelphia 76ers. Terrible, just terrible. The tractor was given to a farmer in the Wausau area after the ride. Former Milwaukee Bucks coach Don Nelson set out on the 7-day, 200-mile trip aboard his tractor through Wisconsin. The first leg took him to Appleton, then he headed to small towns of Hilbert, Chilton, the not-so-small town of Beaver Dam.
That's a big, it's a big
smaller than
detour there from it, Beaver Dam to Chilton.
And he ended in Milwaukee, so that's a pretty good
chunk
of territory to cover in a tractor. Having driven one from this area to Princeton, I feel for how long that probably took him to do that. Nelson raised over $250,000 for his Nellie's Farm Fund in those summers of 86 and 87, and he also donated part of his playoff money to the farmer that wrote him the letter to help him with his problems. So, yeah, kind of a cool deal. And
it's quite a spot to ask for advice from the coach of...
The Bucks.
Like, if... Yes. Like, I'm just...
Like,
if we were to ask the...
Matt LaFleur.
Yes. Let's write in...
I mean, all of us were pretty young at that time when this was going on, but maybe he... It was widely known he was from a farm background.
Right. I was it's cool that Don Nelson grew up on a farm, was able to do this kind of thing where he gave back to... And the type of coach... Do you remember him as a coach much, Bill?
A little bit.
Yes.
Yeah, a little and bit.
Well, I think I read he went to Golden State.
Yes, right.
Around this time. That. So yes. He wasn't with the Bucks.
Right. This would have been, what was cool, the 87 tour was almost like a farewell tour for him because he wasn't the Bucks coach.
Which is ironic because 88 was the drought in one of the worst years in farming.
Right. He got worse even yet.
He didn't come back and drive a tractor again. What the heck?
But he was famous for wearing fish ties.
Yes, so, like, I do remember reading about that.
Like the old school, and during these tours too, they would like auction off the fish ties, which is a cool move. And then even as a coach, that was back in the day. Like, what's odd with coaching is sometimes the attire they wear, as far as like sometimes it's like a suit. Back in the day, it was more of a suit. Now, you know, even like baseball, though, they always kind of wore a similar jersey to the players. And anyway, he got in trouble because he wanted to wear just like...
He wanted to wear basketball shoes.
Yeah, he wanted to wear basketball shoes, and they basically like wouldn't let him. Like, he had to wear... Like, it was just
to put on wingtips.
Right. And now these guys are basically wearing warm-ups, you know, as coaches out there, some of them. And
said he did wear basketball shoes for a couple of games, but he put tape over the logo.
There you go.
So it's probably
a branding thing. Yeah, they didn't want him advertising whatever. Now they're getting paid to advertise. Even coaches get paid to advertise everything. So,
but yeah, so unfortunately he passed away a legend, and very cool that he was from a farm and gave back to farmers. So, all right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts, or on your Android phone, download an app like Spotify or Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny with some current events. So, Cool Beans?
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Where is the best rated corn in the country right now? It's kind of like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? So the overall condition of the U.S. corn crop held steady this week following 3 weeks of decline. Nationwide, 61% of the corn crop is in good or excellent shape as of August 9th, which is the same as last week. Yet the four, for four of the top 18 corn-growing states, more than 70% of the corn crop was rated good to excellent, and that is the states of Minnesota.
Boo.
71% of their corn in good or excellent condition. And
boo.
Then we've got Iowa, which is at 78% good to excellent corn.
Boo. Which they have all the corn. So, like,
there's a lot of corn
there. And I've been through Iowa this summer, and it looks amazing.
I remember earlier when we talked to Alan this summer, and he said how good it was. Yeah, it's just...
And Tennessee is also up there. They're at 80% rated good to excellent, with 31% of that being excellent. And Pennsylvania, rounding out with 89% of its crop rated good or excellent. And none of it, that's right, none of it is poor or very poor. So they only have good, excellent, and fair corn.
I wouldn't
Tennessee.
Think, I wouldn't think Pennsylvania.
Or that's Pennsylvania. Right?
I don't think corn when I think of Pennsylvania.
No.
No? You think of the Dutch. And you think of Hershey. But they're kicking butt when it comes to corn this year. So it'd be interesting to see the spread of acres that are covered in each state. Like how many acres of corn they have compared to these ratings. But yeah, so there is definitely some good corn out there. Unfortunately, there's also some bad corn out there, so. But now we will take a look at our That's Corny for this week. And Floating Farm, ooh, she's done, huh? Folded for now. So you may remember hearing a few years ago about the Floating Farm in the Netherlands, where they had a, I think it was a dairy farm, right?
It was dairy.
Floating on the harbor. So the entrepreneurs, they built the world's first floating dairy to promote sustainability and to stretch the concept of what is farmable. About 2 years ago, they started running into trouble. Their government approved low-emission flooring that began to bulge, tripping up cows and their manure robot. They chose a German-manufactured floor, which also boasted low-emissions design, but that wasn't certified in the Netherlands, so should have went with the German engineering. And that decision is coming back to haunt them and at least temporarily halt them. Although they have put in new flooring and it meets the parameters, the emissions from the barn remain within the legal limits. The Environmental Protection Agency has sanctioned their operation for the uncertified floor. An appeal filed by the farm was unsuccessful, and the regulations will be enforceable beginning August 18th. So rather than reappeal or risk inspections that could ding them tens of thousands of euros, they have decided to shutter their floating farm, at least for now. So I guess it wasn't
a very specific reason. Flooring.
Like,
technically, it.
And that is the.
Technically, it worked.
Right.
You know, and that the experiment wasn't necessarily a failure, but it just. There's always.
Right. In this case, it's government issues that they're running into with certifications. And that is one thing about Europe. We've seen in recent years a harder line when it comes to emissions and all that kind of stuff. So didn't check all the boxes, and now they're forced to shut down, at least for now. Wonder what they're going to do with it. It doesn't say what they're going to do with the cows.
The cows, or like, just are you just going to leave it floating there right for now, empty, or
so? Yeah, interesting to see what happens with that as we move forward. But now we'll wrap things up with a Feel Good Friday. Illinois State Fair has marked two historic milestones. Miles of Smiles is the theme for the Illinois State Fair, which runs August 13th through the 23rd, celebrating its 100th anniversary of celebrating the 100th anniversary of the historic Route 66. Along with vintage cars and signs, the fair will also display tributes to America 250 and include special children's entertainment and grandstand stars. Every day of the fair, there will be a classic car show held by 11 car clubs. Adjacent to the Route 66 experience is the Surfside Social Club, which will have family-friendly entertainment. Great American Sing-Along included in that. And the fair will have the America 250 displays and tributes in the arts, hobbies, and crafts buildings, along with photo and theme jars. The Illinois Department of Agriculture will also have an inflatable barn where children can interact with AI characters. Happy Hollow will once again be an 800-seat big top circus, and there will be a new free dinosaur exhibit. So lots of different things going on there. Each day of the fair will have a different theme. So starting on Thursday the 13th was County Fair and Horse Racing Day. Friday the 14th is Agricultural Day. Kids Day is the 15th. Veterans and Gold Star Day on the 16th. Senior and Scout Day, 17th. Tuesday, August 18th is Tuesday,
ooh,
TWO, with discounted admission offered for adults and seniors, and also on the rides. August 19th, Governor's Day. August 20th is Republican Day. 21st is First Responder and Healthcare Day. 22nd, Park District Conservation Day. And 23rd is the final day of the fair, and that will be Family Day. So they have their butter cow, which is the unofficial icon of the fair since the 1920s. 500 pounds of unsalted butter used to sculpt life-size figure by hand. Also available is ice cream, award-winning cream puffs and milk. They're just copying us now, and they have cream puffs at the Illinois State Fair, too. They'll have rodeo, a bunch of music artists, ranging from Bailey Zimmerman, Lainey Wilson, Matchbox 20, which I didn't even know they were touring. Ella Langley, Chicks, The Chicks, Shinedown, Wiz Khalifa, Ziggy Marley, and the Abbott Brothers. So lots to do, lots to see down there. It's one thing have we ever had like a butter thing at our state fair?
They have.
Like a butter sculpture?
Yes, yeah. But the butter cow is their...
So they've got the butter cow.
Their thing. And
I think, is it Indiana or Iowa? Don't they have a annual butter thing too?
Yeah, there's more, for being what we are in Wisconsin, you'd think we'd have more butter things.
You'd think we'd have something, but anyway, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about Japanese beetles and some other pests that we're seeing in the field. Nothing too serious at the moment, but there are individual areas that may require treatment. In our spotlight, we took a look at salicylic acid, which is related to aspirin, showing promise in addressing plant stress, especially in soybeans. Ag History Minute, we talked about Milwaukee Bucks coach Don Nelly Nelson and his tractor drive to raise money for farmers. Cool beans this week. Best rated corn. 4 states are beating the average. That's corny. The floating farm in the Netherlands has shut down, at least for now. And our Feel Good Friday, the Illinois State Fair, rolling starting this week. And you can check out a really big butter cow. So thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.